Please go on up, the doorman said. They rode the elevator to the 8th floor, packed tight in a small car, turned left on a corridor and stopped at a blue door. It was already standing open. Milena knocked anyway and then led them inside. Tammy Orozco was a small, hunched figure on a sofa. Wild black hair, pale skin, a patterned housecoat. She was probably 40, but right then she could have passed for 100. She looked up. She ignored Reacher and O'Donnell and Dixon and Nagley completely. Didn't look at them at all. There was some hostility there. Not just jealousy or vague resentment like Angela Frowns had shown. It was real anger instead. She looked directly at Milena and said,
Manuel is dead, isn't he?
Milena sat down beside her and said,
These guys say so. I'm very sorry.
Tammy asked.
Jorge, too?
Milena said.
We don't know yet.
The two women hugged and cried. Reacher waited it out. He knew how it went. The apartment was a larger unit than Sanchez's. Maybe 3 bedrooms, a different layout, facing a different direction. The air was stale and smelled of fried food. The whole place was battered and untidy. Maybe because it had been tossed 3 weeks ago. Or maybe it was always in a state of chaos with 2 adults and 3 children living in it. Reacher didn't know much about children, but he guessed Orozco's 3 were young, from the kind of books and toys and scattered clothing he saw lying around. There were dolls and bears and video games and complex constructions made from plastic components. Therefore, the children were maybe 9, 7, and 5, approximately, but all recent, all post-service. Orozco hadn't been married in the service. Reacher was fairly sure of that, at least. Eventually, Tammy Orozco looked up and asked,
How did it happen?
Reacher said, The police have all the details.
Did he suffer?
It was instantaneous, Reacher said, as he had been trained to long ago. All service KIAs were said to have been killed instantly, unless it could be definitively proved otherwise. It was considered a comfort to the next of kin. And in Orozco's case, it was technically true, Reacher thought. After the capture, that was, and the mistreatment, and the starvation, and the thirst, and the helicopter ride, and the writhing, screaming 20-second freefall.
Why did it happen?
Tammy asked. That's what we're trying to find out.
You should. It's the very least you can do.
It's why we're here.
But there are no answers here.
There must be, starting with the client. Tammy glanced at Milena, tear-stained, puzzled.
Client? Don't you already know who it was?
No, or we wouldn't be here asking.
They didn't have clients,
Milena said, as if on Tammy's behalf.
Not anymore. I told you that.
Something started this, Reacher said. Someone must have come to them with a problem, at their office or out in one of the casinos. We need to know who it was.
That didn't happen,
Tammy said. Then they must have stumbled over the problem on their own, in which case we need to know where and when and how. There was a long silence, then Tammy said,
You really don't understand, do you? This was nothing to do with them. Nothing at all. It was nothing to do with Vegas.
It wasn't.
No.
So how did it start?
They got a call for help. That's how it started. One day, suddenly, out of the blue, from one of you guys in California, from one of their precious old army buddies.
Chapter 51. Azari Mahmoud dropped Andrew McBride's passport in a dumpster and became Anthony Matthews on his way to the U-Haul depot. He had a wad of active credit cards and a valid driver's license in that name. The address on the license would withstand sustained scrutiny, too. It was an actual building, an occupied house, not just a mail drop or a vacant lot. The billing address for the credit cards matched it exactly. Mahmoud had learned a lot over the years. He had decided to rent a medium-sized truck. In general, he preferred medium options everywhere. They stood out less obviously. Clerks remembered people who demanded the biggest or the smallest of anything. And a medium truck would do the job. His science education had been meager, but he could do simple arithmetic. He knew that volume was calculated by multiplying height by width by length. Therefore, he knew a pile containing 650 boxes could be constructed by stacking them 10 wide and 13 deep and 5 high. At first, he had thought that 10 wide would be a greater dimension than any available truck could accommodate. But then he realized he could reduce the required width by stacking the boxes on their edges. It would all work out. In fact, he knew it would all work out, because he was still carrying the 100 quarters he had won in the airport. They gave their condolences and Curtis Mawney's name to Tammy Orozco and left her alone on her sofa. Then they walked Malena back to the bar with the fire pit. She had a living to earn, and she was already 3 hours down on the day. She said she could get fired if she missed the happy hour crush later in the afternoon. The strip had gotten a little busier as the day had worn on, but the construction zone was still deserted. No activity at all. The slick in the gutter had finally dried. Apart from that, there was no change. The sun was high. Not blazing, but it was warm enough. Reacher started thinking about how shallow the dead guy was buried, and about decomposition, and gases, and smells, and curious animals. "You get coyotes here?" he asked. "In town?" Malena said. "I never saw one." "Okay. Why?" "Just wondering." They walked on, took the same shortcut they had used before, arrived outside the bar a little after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. "Tammy's angry," Malena said. "I'm sorry about that."
"It's to be expected," Reacher said.
"She was there when the bad guys came to search. Asleep. They hit her on the head. She was unconscious for a week. She doesn't remember anything. Now she blames whoever it was who called for all her troubles."
"Understandable."
"But I don't blame you," Malena said. "It wasn't any of you that called. I guess half of you were involved and half of you weren't."
She ducked inside the bar without looking back. The door closed behind her. Reacher stepped away and sat down on the wall where he had waited that morning.
"I'm sorry, people. We just wasted a lot of time. My fault entirely." Nobody answered. "Nagley should take over. I'm losing my touch."
"Mahmoud came here," Dixon said. "Not L.A.
"He probably made a connection. He's probably in L.A. right now."
"Why not fly direct?"
"Why carry 4 false passports? He's cautious, whoever he is. He lays false trails."
"We were attacked here," Dixon said. "Not in L.A. Makes no sense."
"It was a collective decision to come here," O'Donnell said. "Nobody argued."
Reacher heard a siren on the strip. Not the bass bark of a fire truck, not the frantic yelp of an ambulance, a cop car, moving fast. He glanced up toward the construction zone a half mile away. He stood up and moved right and shaded his eyes and watched the short length of the strip he could see. One cop was nothing, he thought. If some construction foreman had finally showed up for work and found something, there would be a whole convoy. He waited. Nothing happened. No more sirens, no more cops, no convoy. Just a routine traffic stop, maybe. He took one step more to widen his view, to be certain. Saw a wink of red and blue beyond the corner of a grocery store. A car, parked in the sun, a red plastic lens over the taillight, dark blue paint on the fender. A car. Dark blue paint, he said. I know where I saw that guy before. Chapter 52. They stood around the Chrysler at a cautious and respectful distance, like it was a roped-off exhibit in a modern art museum. A 300C, dark blue, California plates. It was parked tight to the curb, locked up, still and cold, a little travel-stained. Nagley took out the keys that Reacher had found in the dying guy's pocket and held them at arm's length, like the guy had held the gun, and pressed the remote button once. The blue Chrysler's lights flashed, and its doors unlocked with a ragged thunk. It was behind the Chateau Marmont, Reacher said, just waiting. That same guy was in it. His suit matched the sheet metal exactly. I took it for a car service with a gimmick.
The others told him we would come, O'Donnell said. At first as a threat, I suppose, and then later as a consolation. So they sent the guy to take us out. He spotted us on the sidewalk, I guess, just after he hit town. We were right there in front of him. He got lucky.
Real lucky, Reacher said. May all our enemies have the same kind of extreme good fortune. He opened the driver's door. The car smelled of new leather and plastic. The interior was unmarked. There were maps in the door pocket, crisp and folded. That was all, nothing else on show. He slid in and stretched a long arm over the glove box lid, opened it up, came out with a wallet and a cell phone. That was all that was in there. No registration, no insurance, no instruction manuals. Just a wallet and a phone. The wallet was a slim thing, designed to be carried in a trouser pocket. It was a stiff rectangle made of black leather with a money clip built in on one side and a credit card pocket built in on the other. There was a wad of folded cash in the clip. More than $700, mostly 50s and 20s. Reacher took it all. Just pulled it out of the clip and stuffed it in his own pants pocket. "That's 2 more weeks before I need to find a job," he said. "Every cloud has a silver lining." He turned the wallet over. The credit card section was jammed. There was a current California driver's license and 4 credit cards, 2 Visas, an Amex, and a MasterCard. Expiration dates all far in the future. The license and all 4 cards were made out to a guy by the name of Seropian. The address on the license had a 5-digit house number and a Los Angeles street name and a zip that meant nothing to Reacher. He dropped the wallet on the passenger seat. The cell phone was a small, silver folding item with a round LCD window on the front. It was getting great reception, but its battery was low. Reacher opened it up, and a larger window lit up in color. There were 5 voice messages waiting. He handed the phone to Nagley. "Can you retrieve those messages?"
"Not without his code number."
"Look at the call log." Nagley scrolled through menus and selected options.
"All the calls in and out are to and from the same number, a 310 area code, which is Los Angeles."
"Landline or cell?"
"Could be either."
"A grunt calling his boss?" Nagley nodded.
"And vice versa. A boss issuing orders to a grunt."
"Could your guy in Chicago get a name and address for the boss?"
"Eventually."
"Get him started on it. The license plate on this car, too."
Nagley used her own cell to call her office. Reacher lifted the center armrest console and found nothing except a ballpoint pen and a car charger for the phone. He checked the rear compartment. Nothing there. He got out and checked the trunk. Spare tire, jack, wrench. Apart from that, empty.
"No luggage," he said. "This guy didn't plan on a long trip. He thought we were going to be easy meat."
"We nearly were,"
Dixon said.
Nagley closed the dead guy's phone and handed it back to Reacher. Reacher dropped it on the passenger seat next to the wallet. Then he picked it up again.
This is an ass-backward situation, isn't it? We don't know who sent this guy, or from where, or for why.